When I was in Ecuador particularly, I got involved with some of the mystery sites out there that connect to this idea of, a possible lost civilization that's been, buried by the jungle. And so, some people might have read about this, but there was a site in the Yanganates jungle, which is it's a particularly hazardous area of the Ecuadorian jungle. And where you may have heard of this is for the story of the lost treasure of the Inca. Because when they basically executed Atahualpa, his brother took half, this rumor knowing, took half of the treasure that was en route to the Spanish, and he diverted into the Yanganates, which is essentially swamps, mountains, freezing fogs. It's just a really harsh environment. So, for the Spanish to go in and find this treasure, pretty impossible. But in that same area, what's been discovered is a peculiar megalithic wall. So we're not going to look this up. It was covered in, I think it was the Telegraph, that we ended up going a couple of expeditions into this site where you've got essentially very similar stonework to, you'd see at the megalithic sites in Peru, which is not surprising in that, it borders with Ecuador, of course. But this site is deep into a jungle area where there should be no civilizations, right? The other thing I noticed is between the blocks, there was a kind of mortar. And the Peruvians, all of the known sites with polygonal megalithic blocks have no mortar, right? They're all just perfectly fitted together. There's the story, you can't put a razor blade between them and all that. But well, this had mortar, and that's really weird, because it means this is not the same culture, but it's a very similar style. I believe it's older. I think that what we're seeing here is a site that has been, completely lost to time, overgrown by the jungle, and that could possibly go back to the 12,000 years, time range where we've got this kind of the great devastation at the end of the Younger Dryas. A destroyed megastructure made of silica, that could leave traces. Engineering the genome of humans should leave traces. And a multi-directional bombardment, that's got to leave traces, yeah? And so I thought to myself, well, look, I'm not going to come out straight away and talk about this until I check these enough. So over a period of time, I did a deep dive. And I was frankly astonished to find that, yeah, there is this mysterious rain of glass, of silica glass, that occurs 788,000 years ago. It's called the Australasian Tektite Strewn Field. And for over 130 years, scientists have been trying to understand the exact cause of this glassy rain.
Now, before we jump into the topic of this conversation, just want to make everyone aware that I've recently been demonetized on YouTube. I will be able to reapply for monetization on the 26th of November, but until then, YouTube has turned the tap off in terms of being able to make advert revenue, which was quite a significant portion of my income on a monthly basis. I've had a really amazing outpour of support from people via PayPal, Buy Me a Coffee, Patreon, contributing to try and help me get through this short little process of demonetization on YouTube. And I just want to say thank you so much to all of you that have already donated and given what you can. It's really much appreciated. Anyone else who's able to do that to help support my work whilst I kind of navigate through this brief period of demonetization on YouTube, that would be much appreciated. They didn't give me a solid reason why I was demonetized. It was apparently a copyright infringement, but they didn't specify the video. I tried to reappeal and they denied my reappeal. So yeah, that's my situation right now.
Before we get too deep into the whole kind of techno signature tektite side of this, which is fascinating, just in general, where do you sit on the discussion around pre-cataclysmic civilizations on Earth? Was there a great city of Atlantis? Was there an advanced culture before our own history? It's starting to become quite a popular discussion point, mainly because of people like Graham Hancock, of course, popularizing it, looking forward to his new Netflix series. But what do you think about this whole concept? Where do you sit specifically on these kind of timeline contradictions and debates?
Yeah, I mean, I'm fascinated with the topic, as you can probably imagine. And so I've also been fortunate to meet Graham Hancock a couple of times. Once in Mexico, actually, at a conference there, a 2012 conference. So many years ago, we've traveled to a number of, Maya sites with him, which was really cool. I've met him in Cheltenham at book launch. And he also wrote the foreword to one of my books, which was really cool, to be honest, as you grow up with these names, and then to actually have someone like that write the foreword to your book, it was pretty awesome. Yeah, so because of my interests. You know, when I was in Ecuador particularly, I got involved with some of the mystery sites out there that connect to this idea of, you know, a possible lost civilization that's been, you know, buried by the jungle. And so, you know, some people might have read about this, but there was a site in the Yanganates jungle, which is it's a particularly hazardous area of the Ecuadorian jungle. And where you may have heard of this is for the story of the lost treasure of the Inca, because when they basically executed Atahualpa, his brother took half this room, you know, he took half of the treasure that was en route to the Spanish, and he diverted into the Yanganates, which is essentially swamps, mountains, freezing fogs. You know, it's just a really harsh environment. So, you know, for the Spanish to go in and find this treasure, you know, pretty impossible. But in that same area, what has been discovered is a peculiar megalithic wall. And so, anyone can look this up. It was covered in, I think it was the Telegraph, that we ended up going a couple of expeditions into this site where you've got essentially very similar stonework to, you know, you'd see at the megalithic sites in Peru, which is not surprising in that, you know, it borders with Ecuador, of course. But this site is deep into a jungle area where there should be no civilizations, right? The other thing I noticed is between the blocks, there was a kind of mortar. And the Peruvians, all of the known sites with polygonal megalithic blocks have no mortar, right? They're all just perfectly fitted together. You know, there's the story, you can't put a razor blade between them and all that. Well, this had mortar, and that's really weird because it means this is not the same culture, but it's a very similar style. I believe it's older. I think that what we're seeing here is a site that has been, you know, completely lost to time, overgrown by the jungle, and that could possibly go back to the 12,000 years, you know, kind of time range where we've got this kind of the great devastation at the end of the Younger Dryas. The reason why I say that, and again, this connects to some other unconventional research down in Brazil where you've got the Lagoa Santa people. And if anyone's not familiar, the Lagoa Santa are essentially the oldest Americans. And again, the Brazilian archaeologists are finding sites that suggest there were people down there 40,000 to 50,000 years ago. And the Lagoa Santa type people also found in cave sites in Ecuador. And there's a link going back to the same area where this megalithic wall is. So my suspicion is that we've got like Lagoa Santa people that have built megaliths in that region very, very, very long time ago. And that this has been so wiped out by the earth changes and the loss of the story that you no longer know, you know, who these people were, why they were in that jungle, you know, is completely lost to history. And the quick add-on to that, you might be familiar with the finds at La Mana in Ecuador as well. And if anyone's not familiar, the La Mana artifacts were found in a gold mine kind of prospecting project. There was a tunnel out in the jungle. The guys went in there and they found it's hundreds of artifacts. And amongst them, you've got a boulder that shows a map of the Earth, but with additional land masses that we would associate with, you know, potentially with the stories of Atlantis. There's a kind of a landmass off the side of South America. There's another one off this, you know, the side of Europe, and a marker stone, which seems to indicate somewhere in the Middle East with an eye in it, which has been jammed into this rock, which seems to mark some particularly special site. You also got artifacts there that have an Olmec type number system on them, which is kind of funny because, of course, you know, it's a fair way from Mexico down to sort of the, you know, the Ecuadorian jungle, which again links to, I think, a lost civilization that we would connect to the Olmec type people. My suggestion is that we're looking at the original people of the Americas who would be Aboriginal Australian or Papuan types. And I can come to that again very quickly. I'll just add on because straight away people say, what do you mean? Why would there be, you know, Aboriginal or Papuan people in South America? Right. Well, it turns out that when they started doing the genetics of the indigenous people of the Americas, they found amongst these two of the isolated jungle tribes that they have direct genetic links to Papuan people, right? So you can imagine they were thinking, well, how can that be? How can you have a link to Papuan people in the isolated jungles of Americas, right? And also amongst these people, one of the tribes actually has star lore that when they look up at the sky, they see along the dark rift of the Milky Way, Rhea Bird stretched along it. If you go to Aboriginal Australia, you'll find several nations there who say there's an emu stretched along the dark rift. The rhea and the emu are essentially identical. They're very closely related birds. So if you find genetic links and cultural links, you've got to start saying there's a direct link here. And that direct link has to be extremely old to have people in the isolated jungles, right? who have that link. These are not people that come in recently. So when you put these different factors together, it looks like the Lagoa Santa are the first people. They're the ancestors of the Olmecs. The Olmec faces are Aboriginal, not African, and then you have the DNA links there as well. So there's an unfolding story of a lost migration, which involved, I would say, people from Indonesia, Northern Australia, and that region who moved out into the world, I would say 40 to 50,000 years ago, but you would have waves coming out from a culture there, which I'll give you a sec, jump back in a sec, because I go through my monologues, just very quickly, so people understand that if you go down to Indonesia, and the reason why this should make sense is because, first of all, we know that humans were in Indonesia going back, hominins and humans going back at least 1 million years ago, right? So the earliest fossils in the Indonesian islands are 1 million years old. So people had to have used watercraft to get there. This is considered impossible to reach these islands at any time in history without watercraft, okay? So that was a very early navigation. We also know that when modern humans reached these islands, that they developed deep sea fishing at least 40,000 years ago, judging by hooks and artifacts that have been found in cave sites. Think about this, Jay. If they are doing deep sea fishing at 40,000 years old, right? What do you think their boats are like, say, 20,000 years ago? I mean, if we think about this, the development curve of their navigation, knowledge, and engineering would have been, you know, massively accelerated. They're traveling between islands all the time. They're deep sea fishing all the time. This culture would have been a maritime culture. And when you start seeing that, you know, this type of people are turning up in South America, then they're navigating to South America, right? And then you also see fingerprints of some of their knowledge at sites like Göbekli Tepe, where, for example, I'll give one example. If you look at Pillar 43, which is the most famous, you know, representation we see, where we see the bird, you see the handbags, and so, you know, so the classic image that we get seen many, many, many times, where everyone's seen it. But on that iconography, you've got a bird turned looking to its left over its wing, looking at a circle in the air next to it. Well, you'll see that exact same imagery in Northern Australia, and that is from the story of the emu lady or emu man and the forbidden fruit, which was a forbidden knowledge that was taken. Now, to find the same iconography in coastal Australia, right, among some of the earliest art that we have, and a Göbekli Tepe, you have to start scratching your head and saying, what's going on here? You know, how can these places be linked? And why are we finding Aboriginal, you know, bloodlines in the Amazon jungle? So my feeling is that we have a lost maritime culture that was at least partly based on the Indonesian islands and Northern Australia. Now, it may not be what we refer to as Atlantis, but it would probably be one of the maritime cultures, you know, that's around at that time and possibly, you know, was part of a greater maritime culture that is spread around the world, which we could say is the Atlantis myth, is, you know, obviously a culture that could navigate the world. And that you find these traces now of people who should not be in these locations, we're finding them. The same as this megalithic rock work that we see again and again. We see it in, you know, the polygonal megalithic blocks, which appear, of course, in Europe, in Africa, in South America. You know, we're finding that same style globally. And it's not a style you would think would naturally develop independently because it doesn't really make sense, you know, that, and also why the use of huge blocks? Why not small bricks? Very logical that you break the rock up. And so this is some kind of cultural idea that is spread globally. So for me, it's pretty clear we've got the fingerprints of, I would say, people that were navigating the world at least in that time frame, 20 to 50,000 years ago.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, you know, there's so many contradictions in the kind of entrenched orthodox historical narratives that we're given. And this is just kind of becoming more and more obvious as we're analyzing through LIDAR, as we're doing these different archaeological digs, and as we're assessing the history books with more clarity. And it's just interesting to me that there's such an intense level of resistance. Now, like, do you think that that comes down primarily to just institutionalized dogma and the belief that, well, we've created this model, this is challenging the model and trying to ignore controversial facts that damage the structure that we've kind of created? Do you think it just comes down to that type of dogmatic issue that we see in religion and science, or is it something a little deeper? Is it something that speaks to a time where humanity was something even greater than it is now, and perhaps that's dangerous information?
I think there's at least three angles to why we see this, and, you know, one of them certainly is the dogmatic framework of the academic world, that, you know, you will have the expert in the field lecturing to the next generation, telling them, you know, this is basically how it is. And they will take that on board most of the time as literally true. They also know that they go against the main narrative, that that can be damaging to your career. That, you know, you want to impress the boss, which is, let's be honest, is normal in most jobs. Do you really want to go up against, say, you know, the most famous anthropologist, and you're fairly new to your career, and you start speaking out saying that you think his theory is full of rubbish? Probably not. So there's definitely the pressures you can imagine in any kind of career path. And we hear about it in the sciences as well. There's a lot of people say that they are scared to speak out about errors that they're, you know, the esteemed prize-winning scientists are putting on TV, right? Because do you want to be the person who goes up against them and their kind of, you know, their clique and potentially be ruined? No. So that is definitely a big part of it. But I'd say also we have, when you look at the, say, the anthropological world, you've got a couple of other forces as well. One of them is today, it's very left-leaning. You've got a lot of bias in there about, you know, how society should work. And this is obviously a topic. It's all about society, people, human stories. So there is certainly a bias in there towards what I'd say is the new kind of radical framework for viewing human beings. That has also come out of a reaction to the past of anthropology. You've got to remember, anthropology is responsible for racism, right? That the whole initial kind of field had based around this idea that, you know, there were these primitives, and then, you know, that the white people were really the civilizers, and that, you know, that the black people were more like apes. You know, this all came out of early anthropology, right? The other problem that we have there is that they initially were spreading stories about lost civilization, like Atlantis, and that some of the, you know, the quite sort of esteemed thinkers of the early anthropological field were promoting the idea that, like, the Mayans and stuff were outliers of a lost civilization. But, like, as those stories began to kind of crumble, it turned out that their readings of, say, like, Maya glyphs were just wildly wrong. And then, you know, their readings of Egyptian hieroglyphs and stuff were misleading. You know, eventually there was a kind of a pushback that this is basically hokey pseudoscience, you know, and also tinged with racism and white supremacy. So, I mean, those were real problems at the time, right? So the reaction to that has been what I'd say is an overreaction, an extreme pushback, where any discussion of the idea of a contamination of cultures from outside, or that some kind of proto-culture, that they see that straight away as you are stepping into that quagmire that they kind of created, and that they now see that as a completely taboo idea, that there is a proto-culture, or that these cultures have arisen by contact with other more advanced groups, right? So if you sort of put those two things together, you can see why it's so difficult to have a reasonable conversation on this topic with most professional anthropologists, right? Some will, you know, some of us diverging, but I mean, I think they're understandable problems, but they are hampering, you know, the exploration of some of these topics. Keep in mind as well that, you know, these are social sciences, they're soft sciences, they're storytelling. I don't think anyone should feel beholden to someone else telling them their interpretation of evidence is somehow absolutely correct because they're slightly more scientific in their thinking. But where I think that we do have to say, you know, I guess, bend a bit towards the scientific view is with the hard sciences, when you have a geologist dating a site, I believe the geologist, you know. I mean, I can't go and date a site myself, right? So if we were going to do any kind of independent research, we rely on the hard sciences, we rely on geologists, we rely on chemists, we rely on biologists, yeah? But when it gets to the anthropologists, essentially they're taking that same evidence that we can look at ourselves and they are putting it into a framework and telling a story. So that is not hard science, you know? That is storytelling. It may be informed by hard science, but you and I, anyone who is, let's say, intellectually capable, can go and read the same source analysis, right? And look at the chemistry, look at the geology, and then come to our own story. And that's really what independent research is, and what they would call pseudoscientists and pseudo-archaeologists. And these are kind of absurd names. You know, I've never done any anthropology. You know, I've never done, archaeology. I've never done anthropology. I've never done, you know, I'm not pseudo-geologist or anything. You know, they come up with any terms they like. The reality is that people like myself, or, you know, Graham Hancock or yourself, we can go and read these studies and say, well, when I put them together, it looks like a slightly different story to me than the one that you're telling me. And you know, I'm not going to make up any evidence. I don't go and pretend to do digs, Jay. You know, I don't go, you know, by shovel and say, you know, I'm excavating this for myself. you know, then you could say I'm a studio archaeologist, right? Because I'm not trained to do that, and I wouldn't be able to send it off to labs any of the stuff, right? So yeah, I would agree. If you do that, then you could say that's some kind of pseudo archaeology, yeah. And that did happen in the past. Now I think nearly anyone that's interested in these topics does utilize the sciences and relies on all of those datings and all the rest of it. You know, we're not going to go and make those up. If someone does make them up and people do, then I would say that those people are guilty of pseudoscience, right? Because, you know, I'm sure you've talked to people who just say, well, you know, I think it's that old, but, you know, but these people, the dating saying it's 20,000, yeah, but I think it's 100 million years, you know, like, so of course you've got to, you know, recognize that is a problem as well, that there's people on the, what I would say more on the independent research side, who are totally distrustful of the sciences and will just kind of fit the evidence around the story they already have. So, you know, there is a bit of both, right? So that's how I view, you know, the problems that we're seeing in that field. So there's different directions where we're seeing kind of pushback coming out of these historical issues.
I mean, a good example, obviously, is the visceral reaction in the mainstream media almost immediately to the announcement of Graham Hancock's Netflix series. That was such a weird one to me when I just suddenly saw this, like, absolute wave from international mainstream media calling him right-wing and saying that he was promoting racist ideologies. So do you think that that kind of thing comes down to primarily the primarily this entrenched belief system and a concern from within this belief system that kind of permeates through academia that these narratives reinforce radical ideologies? You know, I mean, obviously there is the thread of connection to the, you know, neo-Nazi alt-right and the belief in Atlantis and the Hyperboreans, that kind of like mythos that certainly formed a foundation of part of that type of ideology. But that doesn't mean it's just a directly alt-right or racial talking point to discuss alternatives in history. I find that to be such a strange one. So this incredible attack on Graham Hancock, I mean, I don't want to get too conspiratorial, but it just feels like there's something more that got triggered by that. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. You have, you know, leading anthropologists saying this is the most dangerous show on TV. I mean, think about that. All the things that have been shown on the TV, that this is the one they think is the most polluting, you know, to the human mind, is Graham Hancock explaining his hypothesis that there's been a lot of civilization globally, right? And, you know, I'm sure that you could think of a dozen other shows immediately that we'd think were far more problematic, you know, everything from like exploiting children in shows and really weird stuff that I've seen over the years, where I just could not come to the conclusion that even if you disagreed with everything Graham Hancock said, that you could say that this was the most dangerous show on TV is just totally out there, wild. And I think, in a way, it's done a favor to him and the people in
the first thing you're going to do when you see it's the most dangerous Netflix series ever is watch it.
For sure, yeah.
Like, come on.
And you also don't think, well, he's right that he's being kind of targeted, because it does look like that. It's not just, you know, people fact-checking him, which, okay, we've got to be used to this idea of the fact-checkers. But it's beyond that, you know, and having whole issues of science magazines kind of dedicated to pulling apart Hancock's work and like really bizarre stuff. And this is a guy who, they think so, he clearly is not a right-wing racist, right? He very clearly, if you look at his work, if you look at his ideas, or you meet him, or, you know about his personal situation, like, you know, his wife and his kids and stuff, that this is clearly not a white supremacist, right? So it's a really strange situation. I understand it, because I've had, when I published my book, The Forgotten Exodus, The Inter-Africa Theory, right, which challenges recent out of Africa. Again, remember, that's a very fundamental dogmatic hypothesis, right? It's really a cornerstone of paleoanthropology. I had people that were writing reviews on my book saying that I was an extremist, a right-wing racist and a white supremacist. But the book is first of all, I'm a person of mixed race, right? On one side of my family, we're Black West Indians, and side, white English, right? So it would be kind of absurd for me to try and write a book on white supremacy, right? The second thing is, the book is about Aboriginal people being kind of the progenitors rather than Africans. Can you see how that would be extremely right-wing and racist to kind of swap out Black Africans for Black Aboriginals? So people don't even read it. They just see that you're criticizing this core dogma. Ergo, you must be saying that whites are the best and that it's all right-wing mad. And they wouldn't even go as far as seeing what your ideas were. And I've seen the same thing on social media. I had someone who they saw my profile, and that was enough to say, you know, with you, your radical views that the pyramid was built by aliens, anything, where are you getting this rubbish that you all say that, you know, all these ancient aliens people who believe the pyramids made by aliens and that white culture's built everything? They must be actually getting taught this that that's what we all think if we don't agree with them, that we have the, you know, these, what I would consider absurd ideas, you know, that aliens came down to build the pyramids. For me, there's no basis to that idea, right? But that is in their head. The minute they see that you're kind of considered an alternative researcher, they have a list of things that they're certain you believe without ever asking you, and that you must be far right, you must be a racist. You know, it's bizarre in a way. But that's why I think it has to be kind of institutionalized. You must be being taught to them by their superiors. You know, they're given this idea that these people who don't agree with us, you know, they're all scumbags, they're all on the far right, you know, and if you poke them a bit more, you'll find a Nazi, you know, hiding inside. And that's why, again, I find that troubling, because, you know, they're supposed to be telling the human story back to us, right? And it's coming back to us with the infection of a lot of this warped thinking about, you know, anyone who doesn't agree with them, right? So I think we need a kind of a reset in that field. And again, I don't consider it really a scientific field. You know, I can tell stories. I write books, you know, I tell stories and stuff about why things happened in, you know, certain events. So I understand the principles they're using, but I don't agree that, you know, writing a book or, you know, even a paper in anthropology is hard science. Again, it relies on hard science, but this is storytelling. So I have to be very careful when people want to tell us a story and a narrative and, you know, and saying it's absolutely correct, because you're never going to be absolutely correct about, particularly about historical narratives. That A, you've got to be super selective, right? Because you can't put everything in. Secondly, you know that most of the evidence is missing, right? So I mean, you've got to be very, very careful about coming to a kind of conclusion, like, for example, that there was no lost civilization. You know, if that's kind of in the back of your head, you're going to exclude data that looks like it comes from a lost civilization. Like, if you believe people couldn't have traveled on boats, you will exclude migration routes that involve water lanes, right? And we kind of see that if you look at how the collapse of the sort of the migrations into America, the kind of the model that, you know, everyone walked across a land bridge across Beringia about sort of 12,000, 13,000 years ago, because they had to walk across a land bridge, Jay, because they had no boats. So therefore, there couldn't be anyone in the Americas earlier, right? So sites where things were being found were getting reburied and things like that. There were people who had their careers ruined because they were saying, my site dates to 20,000. And they would be the laughing stock. You know, years later, now some of these people say, you know, my career was in tatters because I dated the site to 20,000 years. And now we realize that, of course, these people had boats, right? So they didn't need to go across the land bridge. It was helpful because you could go along the side of it, you know, and stop and hunt, but they didn't need it. And it meant that there were people in the Americas 20, 30, 40,000 years ago. And I suggest if you go to the south, to Tierra del Fuego, that you had people entering Tierra del Fuego from the south, the ice sheets, right? That they moved across from what today is you know, basically Tasmania, and right across the ice sheet and entered Tierra del Fuego. And you find, again, some Aboriginal type cultures amongst the Tierra del Fuego people. So there was no reason why people couldn't go along the ice with their boats, either in the south or the north, or just end up sailing across. And again, I'll give you another quick point. Think about this. Think of the map of the world. Look at Northern Africa and look at Spain. Now, if you wanted to migrate from Spain to Northern Africa, you know, it's a very long walk, right? It's a very long walk. But if you have a small boat, it's a very short sail, right? And so these things are changing our understanding, you know, because then you realize that, yes, the Mediterranean islands were populated at least, I think in some cases, but 200,000 years ago, people had crossed to some of these islands. There's an island, Sumatra, off the coast of Southern Africa. Again, archaeological finds a million years ago, it had to have sailed there. The populating of the Indonesian islands a million years ago had to have sailed there. So, like, you start thinking about that. Like, if there were even pre-kind of human, you know, hominin-type people that were able to do this, then you have to infer that modern humans, you know, have always been able to sail. Like, for that statement out, they've always been able to sail. I don't believe that if Homo erectus could figure it out, that we can start saying that these modern humans were limited to any time to walking, right? That they've always been able to do this. It's also very likely that they had things like wooden carts and wheels, right? Again, why do we think that? It's because very recently they found wood fragments from an engineered structure, probably a bridge or something like that, that was 700,000 years old. 700,000 years old. So you think about it, Jay, if people were engineering significant large structures with wood 700,000 years ago, how much wood culture have we not seen in the record because it rotted away?
Well, that's it. I mean, it would degrade away. You'd have no evidence. Where was that found, by the way?
So that, I believe that's a find in Africa. If you have a look at that one, that's so that completely shifts the narrative, because now you can think about lost cultures who had wooden houses, wooden carts, you know, wooden chairs, wooden weapons, and that what you would find if you excavate that site is some stone axe heads, right? So if you tell the story of a culture that was wood-based and you tell it through the eyes of today's, you know, archaeological evidence, you will probably just find some stone tools, ceramic pottery, and you would miss the entire culture, because you wouldn't know they had wooden houses. You wouldn't know they had wooden carts. You wouldn't know they had spears. You wouldn't know, do you know, all of that's gone. I think we're starting to realize, again, that goes with the boats. And there was an argument, I think Graham Hancock had, or someone that was talking on his behalf when he was talking to Flynn, the professor, the archaeologist professor, where he was kind of talking about this maritime culture, and Flynn kind of cast it, well, what, we don't see these ships, you know, from this culture in the seabed, which is absurd, because you're not going to find an intact 30,000-year-old wooden boat. You're not, right? It's rotted away. That's long gone. So there's some really strange arguments about, you know, the absence of evidence being the evidence that they can use to say, well, that's for sure then that they weren't there. And it's like, well, now that's why I like that we're finding some of these pieces, because then you have to stop and say, well, that shows straight away that we had it completely wrong and that these people were building bridges and stuff nearly a million years ago.
It makes you wonder what the critical threshold of, you know, pieces that are being put together would be to kind of sway opinion on that, because, you know, obviously, I mean, bias works on both sides. So obviously those of us who are interested and invested in this type of idea will probably see evidence a little quicker than other people who are not on board with it. But at the same time, you know, when you have places like, you know, prime example, Göbekli Tepe, so for so long, this was considered just a land of hunter-gatherers that were just living a very basic life. Suddenly, here is this incredible complex. So it's just proving that underneath the earth and in so many areas, the jungle in the Amazon, you know, the LIDAR, we were talking about that on X the other day. You know, these are things that need to be done, because there is so much more hiding. I mean, it's incredible what we are already discovering. And it just makes you realize that actually underneath the surface, there's an entire world of history that we haven't discovered.
Well, yeah, and I think particularly just, you know, people take into account the realization just of boats going back way earlier than before. Is, you know, that again, that undercuts that narrative that we couldn't have had a global culture and that we wouldn't have had global contamination of cultures, because that becomes absurd. Because even if you just said that every now and again one of these boats was washed the wrong way, well, that's cultural contamination, right? Because straight away, that person, if they wash from Africa to South America, or, you know, that they take the wrong route across the Bering Strait, whatever it is, that person can bring their culture and their tools and everything with them, right? So I think just the recognition that we were moving around on boats hundreds of thousands of years ago really poo-poos the whole argument that the anthropologists have, that all these are kind of pure cultures, and that, you know, that we've got to protect these pure stories of these pure cultures, and that you're trying to bring in this idea of contaminants from, you know, these other, you know, particularly if they're white, but other societies, you know, particularly if they're white societies, then that's really a problem. But again, if you ask some of the, you know, the wisdom keepers in some of the indigenous societies, their own stories talk about contamination. And that's what I think is kind of ironic, because we'd be accused of trying to warp the stories of the indigenous people. But in many cases, you talk to indigenous people and their story involves things like aliens coming, right? Or non, you know, people from out their civilization arriving as wisdom tellers, you know, sharing information with them, right? So how do we do justice to the indigenous people, you know, if we don't actually recognize that they also have those kinds of stories? You know, you can't just, what if, I should always blackwash it. I don't know if they would, maybe that's the way for it. But, you know, it's just, you know, you can't have a story of some white guy washed up in the boat and he tells them, like, you know, well, I've got this kind of axe. You know, why don't you, that even that, you know, is maybe a bridge too far, that, you know, no, these are pure people living in their jungle. And they never saw any of that. So I don't know. I do think that that's hampered the story, because particularly, again, with that megalithic, the wall building. Now, you can see, I can see, most people can see that this is a kind of engineering that is very unlikely to have arisen spontaneously separately in so many different places, because it doesn't look like a logical way to build things, right? So then you have to infer that somehow the idea of building like that is flowing across regions, you know? And this is not an unreasonable take. It's the most sensible take. Instead of these, always, no, all these ideas spring up autonomously because we're all humans and we can all have the same idea. It's a very weak argument in many of the cases, particularly you've got, you know, shared iconography and maybe very similar stories. I mean, we have, like, for example, you have the Genesis story amongst the Hebrews, where we have, you know, the beginning story is, you know, this object, something hovers over the waters, you know, it parts the waters and essentially creates the landscape. But the same stories in the Popol Vuh with the Maya, right? They say in the beginning, this thing's hovering over the waters, there's been some kind of cataclysm, and this thing hovers over the waters, it separates out the fresh water, and, you know, and then the new era begins. Well, hang on a minute, are we really going to say that some Mayan guy sitting on his mountain, he just happens to invent the same creation story as a Hebrew tribesman, right, living on the other side of the world? I mean, doesn't it seem to you that maybe there's either, well, there's either some cross-contamination or they're both seeing the same thing happen, at the least, right? But this isn't a case where you can just say people are inventing the same things all the time. That's where I think they lose, the academics lose people, because you sit down, you think to yourself, hey, do you really believe the rubbish you're saying? Because I can't believe it. I can't believe that these two people would come up with the exact same creation story in completely different cultures, right? So, and you've got examples and examples and examples like that, that, again, not only question what they're telling us, but question our understanding of what happened, you know?
Yeah.
What was this cataclysm? What was this rebirth of civilization? Who were these wisdom people? You know, there is definitely a story there that I think, you know, it's unavoidable that you become fanatically interested once you start to realize it's there.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. And I mean, you know, the flood myths that just exist globally, there's such a strong level of myth, folklore, storytelling evidence to suggest that these all experience something real. I mean, it's a shared testimony going across cultures of a cataclysmic event. And so, yeah, to me, it seems pretty obvious that there is a sharing of cultural experiences there. And also, like, the things that you brought up and talked about a couple of times, the Inca stones and the kind of like the geopolymer. It's an interesting, because there's a debate on that. What do you think of the whole liquid stone proposal, that they were actually kind of molding these rocks in like pouring it into molds, which is why they're so perfect?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen, there's a guy, I don't know the name, but he's been doing experiments to reproduce this, and it does look very compelling. I think that at least in some cases that we are looking at some kind of knowledge of this. I mean, there's also accounts in South America of some kind of flower or plant that you can take the liquid from and it would melt the stone. And I know that there was, I think it may have even been like Fawcett, you know, the guy, the Lost City of Zed fame, Colonel Fawcett, who, the, you know, stumbled onto this, was walking through there, and he found it melted the metal on his you know, gear or something like that. And that, so people would encounter this material that, you know, somehow could melt stone. Also, I know that I think it was Graham Hancock who had, he talked about some analysis done of some stone where, you know, you'd expect to see, I think it's the diatoms or something in the stone. And so that they have been destroyed. And so it looks almost like it was reduced to, you know, either powder or liquid and then reconstituted. And it's missing elements that should be in the natural stone, right? So when you start to get sort of little telltale signatures like that, I think we do have to take seriously the idea that perhaps in some cases people aren't moving, you know, 200-ton boulders, that they're actually moving buckets of sludge.
Yeah.
Just tipping them in. Because again, if something like that is going to be done, I think it's going to be done somewhat easily, for the same reason why we use like small bricks. We do that because it's a lot easier than moving a 200-ton stone. But if you can easily move the 200-ton stone, then you say, well, that's easier than carrying all the bricks. But it's kind of human nature, right? And I think the same kind of thing applies when we look at, of course, across Egypt. But if you look at even something like Silbury Hill, you know, in the UK, you've got the largest mound in Europe. For anyone who's seen it, it really is like a big hill, right? And that supposedly is dug out and moved there, essentially with the antlers from deer or something like that. And you kind of think about it, just think. I mean, I'm not saying it's impossible, but you kind of think to yourself, if you're going to start a grand project like that and you've got to convince other people to do it, they have to believe that this is doable in a way that they're not going to get killed doing it, and it's, you know, it's just madness and you can't build it. I think if you came to your tribe and said, I want to build this big hill and here's a handful of antlers, and we're just, you know, people try to say to you, Jake, we haven't got time for that. You know, this is crazy. We've got farming to do. You know, you'd have to sell them on that this is something fairly easy, you know, and I think the same.
Or incredibly important.
Incredibly important. Yeah. If it's going to be that hard, So why do we see so many projects like that? Are they all believed to be incredibly important? Or are we missing some engineering knowledge here? Because, you know, again, we see that size across the UK as well. You know, there does seem to be some engineering knowledge to moving these stones. I mean, very recently they said Stonehenge that, you know, they realize now that one of the blocks may have come from, you know, the Hebrides or beyond, maybe from outside the UK. They're not quite sure yet. And then on top of that, you've got blocks carried from Wales and stuff. So I think that, you know, if you don't have an easy way of doing this, right, that you don't do it that way. You do it the easier way. You'd say, well, you use stones locally, right? So you go and dig up some, you don't go, right, well, we're just going to drag stones from Wales and Scotland. You know, like, come on, Bob, you know, that's crazy. Do you know what I mean? You would be thinking, these were human beings like us. I think that's something that gets forgotten, that they were human beings like us. They have to speak to the equivalent of Bruce and Jay, and they have to get us somehow convinced that we're going to move tons and tons of stone from Wales and Scotland, and that it's not going to kill us, and it's not going to take so long that we can't feed ourselves, you know, and our families. So that's why I think you have to infer there's lost engineering knowledge. And whenever they do the experiments trying to recreate it using, you know, rolling on wood or putting on rafts, it doesn't work, right? The rafts sink, the logs break. You know, we see this again and again when they replicate them, not just the sites here, but in Egypt. They've tried to make these stone blocks. The drills bend, the copper saws, you know, bust. And, you know, so we can see that it's not the way that the mainstream academics think it was. Like, we don't know how it was done, but we know they are wrong, you know? So that infers that there is definitely engineering knowledge that we are missing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's so many different sites around the world. One of them that's caught my attention recently, because I'm also diving down the whole like psychoacoustic architecture and the deliberate harmonic engineering of some of these temple sites, specifically the subterranean ones, many of them BC. The Hypogeum in Malta, the Hypogeum of Hal Safliani. This is another place that they try and convince us was carved out of antler tools and basic tools. And this is a meticulously crafted, multi-geometric layered subterranean resonance chamber, because they have demonstrated that it literally creates these novel standing wave patterns. It oscillates, like, I think it in the oracle room, which is what they call like kind of the main central nexus of the site. The actual frequency is that of a male voice, like a baritone male voice. You know, there's a lot to be said, and this is kind of going down a slightly different route, sticking with the same thing, but there's a lot to be said about this kind of sacred sound science, this harmonic science, and this is something we're only just tapping into, infrasound and the kind of experiments into changing brainwave states. So I think that, you know, one of the reasons why people say, well, where is the technology, is they don't realize you're standing inside the technology when you go to some of these places. I think that whatever they were doing, maybe from intuitive shamanistic sage experiences and kind of translating that information over time, they seem to be adepts at transcendental consciousness influencing the body, and absent any sort of biophysical or biological knowledge that we have. So that's what interests me, is how did they intuit things we're only just discovering in like the 2000s and onwards, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, again, you know, if you look here at West Kennet Long Barrow, which people are not familiar with the landscape here, you know, you've got Avesbury Stone Circle, which is the largest stone circle, larger than Stonehenge. And then very nearby, you know, in walking distance, you've got Silbury Hill, the largest mound. And then across from Silbury Hill, you've got West Kennet Long Barrow, which is the largest, fairly complete long barrow in the UK, as far as I understand it. But the West Kennet Long Barrow has the acoustic properties built into it as well. That there was experiments done there showing that it produces infrasound. You know, so if you are to use, let's say you use a bull roarer or drums, perhaps in the entranceway, you know, the reverberations in there will create infrasound that would modify brain function. It's on, you know, the same kind of frequencies as brain function. So you'd have these sites, which are getting written off again as burial mounds, which I don't like to use the term burial mound, because
they just have to incorporate exquisite psychoacoustic in
life. Right. You've got that question. This. Why would you do that? You're just going to put, you're going to sling a few dead bodies in it. But instead, you've built it so that it can produce infrasound that affects the human brain. Well, dead people don't need their brain affected, right? So you've got a site that in reality, the people would have probably walked up the hill on a kind of pilgrimage to this site, you know, built up on the hill, overlooking Silbury Hill and Ainsbury. You know, you've got people that are putting this sacred landscape. And you would have no doubt, this is my view, you would have probably gone in, washed in the sacred well, which is not far from that. you'd have the Earth Mother, you know, contacting the Earth Mother, you'd gone into the thing, right, as the sun goes down, because they're east-west aligned, right? So you go in as the sun is dying. And if you look from the top of Long Barrows, most of them, the alignment of the chambers, it looked like a person. It's got legs, arms, and a head. So the internal structure is like a person. You crawl in between the legs. What does that mean, you think? So you're crawling into the womb of the Earth Mother. As the sun god dies, you're dying. You go in. Across the floor is spread a mixture of quartz crystals that catch the light of the moon. And also you have bone fragments from multiple people. These are not complete skeletons normally. They're understood to be skeletons of people who've been buried and then later dug up. So you have a mishmash of bones in there. These are not complete burials. So spread across the floor are the bones of the ancestors. So you're in there with the ancestors in their physical presence and their non-physical presence. You now have somebody at the entranceway who's either spinning a ball aura or playing a drum. So you're in the darkness, complete darkness, which we know modifies brain states, right? And you've got this intense thing going on. You've been told, you know, you're going in there to be reborn. You know, so you can imagine the intensity anyway. And you're now experiencing the effects of mind-altering infrasound and the repetitive sounds of a drum or a ball aura. And at this point, you know, somewhere in the night, you will either meet the Earth Goddess or the ancestors. That is the idea of what's happening to you. And in the morning, as the rays of the new sun come up, reborn, so are you. And you crawl out from between the legs of this mother, and you are reborn to the tribe. Right. Or, Jay, what's the animal center? Well, they just slung a few dead bodies in.
Well, yeah, or they just threw a couple of dead people. Well, no, I mean, this is the thing, man. It's like it would be excusable if it was one site, but it's all over the world, you know, from Egypt to Peru to Ireland. You know, it doesn't matter. Newgrange, another fascinating place in Ireland, which exhibits psychoacoustic properties. Shabim de Huanta, like there's so many different areas around the world. Obviously, the King's Chamber and Queen's Chamber inside the Great Pyramid. That's an incredible place, which is deliberate. Yeah, deliberate psychoacoustic engineering once again. And so, like, you know, it's incredible to me that it's not only just that, it's the placement of these sites. You know, they almost always are on some form of geomagnetic grid line, constellation alignment. And so, you know, you're looking at, in my opinion, almost like a really ancient Tesla tech. So there's no wires, there's no cables, because you're actually kind of piggybacking on the natural mediums of energy around the planet biomagnetically. You're using your own biomagnetic input as well through harmonics and oscillation. Kind of gets even deeper into things like the simulation theory. Are we in a fractal reality because of this recursive feedback loop that you're kind of putting in? And through this, we fall into these wells of consciousness and gain insight. And honestly, man, like, I think that these people were masters of that. And we have just completely lost this history. And it's been suppressed, 100% been suppressed, because these are tools of enlightenment, tools of profound realization, you know?
Absolutely. And we know today that there are still people in the scientific world who get insights through altered states. I mean, you know, there's arguments over where Einstein gained some of his core insights during dreamlike states, you know, daydreaming. We have the case of, I can't remember the guy's name, but the Indian mathematician who said he was talking to Shiva and she was giving him these mathematical, you know, codes, which he still used today, you know, and he said that's where he got them.
I think the cherry on top of the cake is René Descartes, because he's responsible for what we call like modern day reductionism and rationalism. Mm-hmm. And he was given these through a fever dream where he believed he encountered an angel, and an angel came to him and gave him this like message about measurement and number. And he founded rationalism, which is then used to debunk paranormal experiences. So it's like the greatest nodes in science were people who were plugged into that intuitive flow. There's no denying it.
Absolutely. So we can't sort of just say this is the primitive thinking of the part, because we still see these insights working in the sciences today and in understanding today. You know, Richard Parsons and his magical insights that he needed this pentagram booster for the NASA rocket program, which worked. You know, and so, you know, this stuff, it keeps happening. It keeps recurring again and again. So, yeah, we have been in some way cut off from a flow of understanding about how to tune into the greater reality. And, you know, that's, I think, is one of the great tragedies of whatever's happened. Now, whether it's really the effects of some kind of cataclysm and giving us this kind of some kind of psychological devastating blow to the culture, and that we've cut ourselves off from the greater world, or it's just the progression of certain interests and power groups, you know, that have shaped the world the way it is. You know, but something clearly has happened that has kind of denigrated the human connection to its own greater reality. And we see the horrifying effects of that in the way that we have, you know, allowed the dismantling of our world. I won't say that we dismantled the world, but we've participated or allowed the dismantling of the natural world. We've participated or allowed the poisoning of people and the environment and animals. You know, we've participated or allowed this general kind of fall, right? And I think that that's to do with this disconnect. And if you look again at a lot of the indigenous cultures, one of the things that they wouldn't really consider most of Earth, or most, say, most adults today, by the standards of indigenous cultures living and past, would not be considered adults because they haven't been through an initiation, right? And their thinking and understanding of the universe is that of a child. And you would not be able to have an adult conversation with the elders or with these druids or with anyone who had an understanding, because they'd sit and within a few minutes, they would know who were the adults in the room and who were the children. It doesn't matter what age you're at, because that's not the judgment that they're using. They would realize that you were cut off from the knowledge of who you were, how things worked, what the cosmos was. And, you know, I think very few people in our Western culture today would meet the standards of elders in indigenous cultures being considered an adult. That, you know, we've lost initiatory paths of the Western world for the most part. Not all of them, and not everyone. But, you know, it's become, yeah, seen as this kind of antiquated, romanticized idea of, you know, having some druidic party or something. But there was a real meaning and purpose to doing this. And it also prevented the leadership issues we have. Because if you look at the views of, say, some of the Aboriginal cultures and even early Egyptian cultures, that you would have to go through some pretty hardcore initiations to get into a leadership role. And I don't think any of our policies today would have survived some of these, because, you know, they were designed to filter out scumbags from ever getting powerful roles, because they realized that you had to be really careful about who you allowed to get into power. Now, if you can say, there's a story that, and I don't know if it's 100% true, but that in Egypt, in the early periods, that one of the tests of the pharaoh was to be locked in the sarcophagus, airtight, and that if you survived by leaving your body and going into a state of suspended animation for your own consciousness control, you would survive the however long it was, the hour, the 2 hours with no air, because your system has basically shut down and you're now in a kind of an NDE experience. They would open the box afterwards, and if you're still alive, you have shown that you are now a winged pharaoh, one who can fly and walk in the other world, and is sound, you know, to be in that kind of role. Now, what kind of scumbag would get in the box? None. None. You can imagine any of our politicians ready to do something like that? No way, because they are not spiritually prepared people. So if there was anything like that, the Aboriginals as well, they had some tests where it was live or die type tests as well. So you'd have, I don't know the specifics, but they had a number of tests where, you know, if you couldn't pass, you would die. Right. So again, so I'm not saying these are quite like that, but if you think about it, we do need something that winnows out who should be in senior kinds of roles in our society, because we've seen what happens when you don't. And it's a mess. It's a nightmare. You know, so I'd love to see something come back, you know, in terms of these traditions where we go through an initiation and, you know, that everyone who should be in some kind of role guiding other people has been through some kind of initiation, right? And so they have reconnected with themselves, with the greater universe, before taking on some kind of power. Right.
Well, that's it. We have a system that filters in the scumbag,
right,
as a prerequisite to position power. You know, it's like you quite literally can't ascend to the lofty positions of leadership in nation states without having a lot of skeletons in your closet and blackmail. And that's the world we live in. That's the world that we exist in. And, you know, I think a lot of this can be traced back to things like the burning of the Library of Alexandria, you know, the Roman Empire. This very aggressive shift in cultural and theological values and belief systems. I think a lot of that contributed. If you know, I mean, obviously, there's kind of like more modern things like the Age of Enlightenment, this reductionist model in science. But I think that this is quite a historical trauma of a lack of knowledge, and you know, we can't forget the fact that entities like the Vatican have incredible amounts of history under lock and key for specific PhDs and scholars to sometimes peer at if they've got the correct tickets, a little bit like a special access program, silos and stovepipes, but for our own antiquities and history, which is just mind-boggling to me that they can do that, but they do. So, you know, we have pieces of the puzzle buried under strata and in the ocean, but we also have, I think, probably some of the biggest pieces, the most disruptive, are literally under lock and key.
Yeah, I mean, the problem, again, we know this with some of the great archaeological discoveries, that there are all kinds of powerful families who have huge amounts of artifacts in their homes, mm-hmm. like things that were pillaged from Egypt, you know, pillaged from the Americas. No one really knows the scope of the vast treasure of antiquities that have been squirreled away into mansions around the world. You know, and that, of course, there are things as well that are problematic. They're in museums, but they're kept in museum basements, and then they won't be put on display. So we have this kind of a combined problem. You know, as well as that, of course, exist sites that get stolen, you know, artifact theft as well is another problem. So there's a massive part of the, you know, the puzzle that is either, I say, like in private hands or not on public display, you know, and that we can't really piece together the story without some of these. I mean, I know with the La Mana artifacts, which are in mostly private hands, some are in a museum, that the guy said to me, one guy, his family has most of the artifacts. I spoke to the guy. He said that some of them, they won't even let a picture go online because they would fear for their lives, because the implications to the church and to the powers that be would be so dramatic that they would fear for their lives if they would see the images of the artifacts online. He said, so there's only a small fraction of the laminar artifacts you can see on websites. So the vast majority, most likely you will never see, that the families still debate whether to have some kind of small museum and show more of them. But it makes you think. So they're saying, yeah, they know looking at these artifacts that it's so problematic for the story that they would be scared to show them. Mm-hmm. So that's another factor. I mean, and again, that's the world we live in, that people would have to fear that the power of the church or the state would in some way be threatened by a narrative change about how we got here, who we are, you know, what we're capable of.
Well, it's like the physical apocrypha almost. You know, you've got the canon texts in the Bible that were stripped over time and kind of considered to be, not necessary or essential texts, which, you know, happen to be the more interesting ones, actually, if you end up reading them. But it's like, you know, there's an apocrypha of physical items as well. No, these are not acceptable. These are too disruptive. They change something. But the Vatican is always kind of flexing subtly through symbology. I mean, the gigantic pine cone that's just sitting there in the middle of their sweet courtyard. You know, these inferences, they do have an understanding of very deep esoteric knowledge, and quite clearly it's coveted knowledge. You know, they kind of show it through symbology, but that's about it.
Well, yeah, and I think the Catholic Church in particular is interested because they had the very successful model of incorporation of things that they found. So rather than, say, going somewhere and focusing solely on purging, which they did do, but solely on purging and forcing people to change their ideas, they realized at some point, actually, if you absorbed some of the sites and some of the beliefs and, you know, some of the artifacts, and said, but these two are to do with the Catholic faith, they made it a lot easier to bring in the flock, because then those people would say, well, you know, their church is built on the exact same mound where we used to do our ceremonies, you know, and the church does have in it, you know, these skulls like we used to have on the altar, you know, and they would just incorporate things from these cults. We know they did it everywhere they went. They incorporate. That's why a lot of other Christian denominations have a problem with the Catholics, right? Because they say that it's full of pagan iconography and pagan beliefs. And stuff.
Well, I mean, the hat is like the Babylonian fish god.
Right.
You got all these different.
It's full of it. So it was a model that worked. If your main idea was to get big numbers, then that's a genius way of doing it, is to start incorporating things that those people are familiar with, instead of going the evangelical way, where you've really got to get them completely change everything about their lives, everything about their beliefs, and become, you know, totally radically different to the way they were. I mean, yeah, it works for a lot of people, but it's a heck of a lot easier if you can say, hey, we're not so different. Look, we even have our church on that hill where we used to go. You know, things have just evolved a bit, you know? So I think that was kind of genius. Personally, if you want to just have more numbers, right? I think that at some point they realize you can't just do it by the sword and fire and, you know, that. Well, not us, you won't lose most of your flock, right? So, yeah, that's kind of why you see that. But that also preserved streams of knowledge within the church because, of course, you know, they also kept huge libraries and stuff. They didn't just burn everything and throw everything away. They have it kind of squirreled away. So in that respect, I suppose it did actually preserve some of the cultures. And we know as well that in, say, in the Americas, that, you know, it was priests, people often that actually kept some of the artifacts and books and things because they were intellectually interested in the cultures that they were destroying. So we actually do see that there was a kind of a want to preserve some of this lost knowledge, at least by the intellectuals in the church.
Yeah, and embedded into the stonemasonry of the churches themselves, and that's something else that fascinates me, especially after doing research into this avenue. Like, I look at cathedrals and churches with just new eyes now, like especially inside some of these places where you've got clear cymatics, like the cymatic geometries of certain harmonic keys and codes, and it's starting to seem like, there's almost like secret songs written into the walls of these churches, again, kind of hearkening back to this science of acoustics and harmonics and like these sacred tones that have been kept, and of course the stained glass, the geometrics of these places. These all echo the same type of knowledge that's being kept in different ways. So, it's a fascinating part of the historical narrative, like the acoustic sciences, and it makes me wonder, why were they bringing these ton, these 3 ton, 5 ton stones? Like, what in your opinion would necessitate such ridiculous buildings?
Yeah, I mean, I wonder whether the necessities, I'm not sure, but like, again, I think that it does tell us something about their knowledge of engineering also, that I just think that they didn't find it as hard as we are thinking it was, because that's what it stands out to me. But why use those kind of blocks otherwise? Is there a property of keeping the stone in one piece? Is there something that they found it did, better, whether acoustics or, there would have to be some reason, because again, I think logically, any human being can say, well, it's easier to use some just small blocks, right? It's really easy. So if you're going to go that way, even if you have great engineering knowledge, there must be another reason why you're doing it. So yeah, it could be that they found it had slightly better acoustic properties, or that they had some kind of belief around the idea of retaining this kind of more natural look rather than loads of little bricks. That there's something there that they felt was important for these sites to have
It
these
just
huge
makes me
blocks.
wonder, like, where they got that knowledge from, man. Like, who puts that down to them, that they need to be moving 3, 4 ton stones into, astronomical configurations? I mean, this is just, that's the thing, is regardless of having a vacuum of knowledge, which we do, just the fact that these things exist at a period of time that they're supposed to exist in, it's like, why? Who taught them this? What was the impetus to do this?
Right, and it was accepted in all these cultures around the world. So it had been a good sales pitch,
Yeah, like a
right?
DNA. This is pretty important, guys. We need to keep focusing on this. I mean, like, if you're considering these people as hunter gatherers, their basic day to day is survive, eat, survive, eat. They don't have time to be going to Scotland and bringing stones back over. Like, it's incredible. It, like you said, it speaks to an absolute mystery.
Göbekli Tepe, I mean, to me, that again, that very argument, that these people are hunter gatherers, they don't really live in a city as such, supposedly. That, it fits far better than, if we're going to go in with that kind of story, it fits far better with a scenario where somebody sails up the Euphrates or the Tigris, with this knowledge and speaks to these people and tells them how to do this and says it's super important and convinces them. Because again, and I know this is one of Graham Hancock's arguments, is that, that although there is some signs of precursor stonework, so I'm not going to say it totally appears out of nowhere, but it does seem that at least what we see is the more artistic work seems to appear somewhat fully formed. So, I mean, to me, it would fit with some contamination, if you like, that somebody has sailed up that river and has sold the idea of how important it is that they build this massive site with all of this iconography, and that, don't worry about just your hunting and gathering, or that this is more important. Because again, even if you have one person in the culture of this idea, it seems unlikely that you would all adopt it. You see, somebody has sold the idea here that we need to do this. This is a grand plan, and it's going to involve, an understanding of astronomy. It's going to involve an understanding of nature and cycles, and all of this stuff. And we're going to build not just a few. We now know that there are multiple sites, right? They're connected across the region. Not just Göbekli Tepe, but there are several other, maybe as large or larger sites that are buried all around the region. Okay, so this was taken on as a really grand project, a totally culture-altering project. I can only believe that there is a sales pitch here, which is really, really compelling. That this is going to we're going to dedicate an awful amount of our man hours and our food, everything, to this project. You've got to feed these people who are not really contributing. society, if you think about it, they're not producing food. They're just working on stones continually, right? Shaping stones. So you've got to feed all these people and house them and look after them. They're not productive members of society. So why would you be doing that? It's unless you all have been convinced that there is something so super important that you really need all these people dedicated to doing it. So, I mean, these kind of like, I think human factors often get kind of just ignored. You know, it's like, well, it's just something they like doing. You know, it's kind of absurd because we know that it was a kind of grueling life as it was, of meeting out your existence, you know, catching wildfowl and trying to grow the few, you know, grasses that you could eat. And, you know, the idea that then you could turn away, to me, it seems strange. Also, the fact that we have this, the bull link again, which there's a strong link between a kind of a bull cult, right? And that bull cult, again, appears in many other places, that there is this kind of adoration of the skull, of the head, of the bull, you know, and symbolism that we see again in South America, and we see, you know, in Egypt and other places, that this kind of the strange version of the bull, which takes us back to, in my understanding, back to astronomical understanding, that we're going back to one of the earliest recognized astrological symbols of Taurus. And again, that we see not only Taurus, but often we see at these sites the Pleiades, and that these are recurrent focuses of cultures, of Taurus particularly, and for some reason, the adoration of the human skull, the skulls being prepared, cleaned, prepared, and kept, and sort of, you know, adored in some way. And, you know, we've got skulls in the iconography at Göbekli Tepe, but we've got similar iconography around the world, and these skull cults and bull cults, again, spread around the world. So we are seeing, I think, also a deeper connection to the sky world and something particularly about Taurus and that region of the sky. In the Pleiades and Taurus, you know, we find those among some of the earliest rock art as well. If you go to some of the caves in France, and, you know, you find this Pleiades representations and the bull. And also if you go down to Dionysia, where some of these really early rock art sites are being, again, there's indications there. Again, this is the same kind of focus around the world. So, you know, to me, there is a stream of knowledge that goes right back into the Neolithic and, you know, into the cave art and the rock art with the similar kinds of themes. And it always seems to have a sky world kind of connection as well. It's not just about what's going on down here. It's a connection between earth, sky, and underworld. And that we have that shamanic theme of the, you know, that you are connected through the earth, but you're also connected through the sky, and that you kind of this bridge of energy between these different realms, you know. So again, that I think if you have the esoteric view yourself, you kind of see these themes when you look at, you know, into some of these sites, you can realize that what you're kind of touching upon is a kind of more of a shamanic kind of worldview. So I'd say there's what about these connections, again, an interesting shamanic connection is that we know the serpent, you know, is another recurrent theme. The Göbekli Tepe, but also around the world. The serpent was featured, you know, there was a featuring of the a site up in America, the Serpent Mound, which I'm sure you're familiar with, which was in Graham Hancock's documentary. And there's a moment where he talks about, he says, you know, and the interesting about this is you notice there are two feathers coming out the sides of the serpent's neck near the head. He said, you know, this was quite mysterious sort of thing. Well, actually, from my point of view, that's not mysterious, because if you look at the art of the rainbow serpent down in Australia, you'll find exactly that. That it's a feathered serpent. It has two feathers coming out from behind the head. But what is the feathered serpent of the Aboriginal people doing up in, you know, in North America, Serpent Mound? These themes go back so deep. You know, we have the serpent actually in Africa, the earliest sacred, or we think ritual sacred site in Africa, probably 70,000-year-old cave, contains what looks like to be, I think it's a natural formation that looks like a serpent that someone could stand behind and talk from, and you'd have the effect of a talking serpent speaking to you. They think it's the oldest ritual site in Africa. So, you know, these themes keep recurring, that there's a deep, deep wisdom that goes back right into the Neolithic that has proliferated around the world, has been spread, you know, from site to site, and that it's influenced everybody. And if you go back 70,000 years, you know, we all have come out of, you know, at least I would agree that we've come out of some kind of proto-population of modern humans, right? I guess that's where my work in the Forgotten Exodus kind of touched into, is that, you know, I don't agree with the out of Africa story, but we definitely do seem to have a period of a cultural revolution, you know, behavioral cultural revolution around 70,000 years ago that happens most likely in one place, and the place I suggest is somewhere down in Oceania, right? Because the reason I say that is if you look at where is the oldest figurative rock art in the world, on the Indonesian islands and like northern Australia, right? So you seem to have this flowering of consciousness where we are no longer just drawing zigzags and crosses, and you know, these are pictures of animals and beings and, you know, flemphrophropes and, you know, bird-headed men and stuff. But so something switches on, right, in the human mind around 70,000 years ago, seemingly in that religion. And then it spreads from there. Now, if you put this again with these are maritime people, right? They're living on islands. They have to have watercraft. So when we see this radiating out across the world, when you put together a maritime culture and the first flowering of knowledge, like, should we be shocked to see the same themes all around the world? I think not. And we know that 70,000 years ago is the beginning of the kind of the flow of migrations that populates the rest of the world, right? So the people arrive in Europe 60,000 years ago. East Asia has been populated by about sort of 50, 60,000 years ago. We've got this flow of people moving. So if they already have stories and they already have art and they already have some kind of shamanic belief system, why wouldn't that flow out to all these different areas? Like, why is there, you know, again, this fear of the idea of a proto-culture that even though we see it in these narratives of serpents everywhere and the narratives of, you know, this primal woman, the Earth Mother, and we keep having the same stories recurring again and again. I also would say that, you know, if we look at what else is happening around that time, you've got this destructive event. You've got the Lake Toba supervolcano, which were cataclysms. The Lake Toba supervolcano, right, occurs about 73,000 years ago, right? One of the most powerful eruptions in certainly in modern-ish times, right? You know, so we've had the entire northern hemisphere is encased in a kind of dust cloud, like a nuclear winter. So animals are dying. Water is being poisoned, you know, it's acid rain coming down. You know, it's not good times, right? It's not good times for the Northern Hemisphere. Well, that doesn't mean that all the people die, but we know there's going to be a significant die-off. And there's also going to be pressure for you to move because where are you going to go? You're going to try to go south, right? Because things are getting really bad. So at that exact time is when we see the sudden appearance of new genetic lineages in East Africa, right? This is where the reverse argument goes for the Arab Africa, is that you have the sudden appearance of both male and female lineages in East Africa 70,000 years ago. Now, the conventional view has always argued that this is a sudden kind of change in people living there before they go out and populate Eurasia. Well, hang on a minute. It's recognized Eurasia is having a really bad time. In fact, you've got the most arid, dry conditions, right, in the Levantine region for pretty much forever, right? You've got horrendous droughts and problems because of what's going on. So the reality is that this is the worst time to move east. Absolutely. It's really recognized. I'm not going to, this is an academic view. The worst time to leave Africa would have been around 70,000 years ago, exactly when they tell us it happened. So in other words, you'd be heading west and south because of the cataclysm. So you, funnily enough, you have the appearance of these lineages and the appearance of arrowheads and the, you know, the ochre engraving zigzags, you know, that are found on stones up there. These are all markers of a new culture and new people, right? So they've moved into Africa. And we also know that those same lineages are seen flowing westward in the genetic data. So in other words, they're going in and mixing with the existing population, right? And you think about it, if they've got arrows and the other people haven't, they're going wherever they want, right? Because they've got the upper hand. So even if they are not welcome, they may have been welcome. If they weren't, they have ranged weapons. So they are going into Africa. And so we see all the traces of this. This is kind of, again, so you think on the other side of it. So what's going on the other side of the world? Well, if you've got people crossing the Babel Mandab and they're entering East Africa, what about the people that are too far away? Where do they go? Well, the people down in the East, they can only cross down into Indonesia, right? And down towards Australia. So if they move, but what would we see down there? We expect to see some traces of that, right? So one of the things that stands out, if you go to, you look at Papua, right? Papua has something like, I think it's 60% of all the languages in the world are on Papua, right? 60%. It's one island. One island has the majority of the world's language. And these are mostly, like, they're called isolates. So languages that are totally unrelated to each other. But the other thing you find amongst Papuan people is that they have uniquely strong lineages of Denisovan DNA, right? They have the lineages of at least two or three distinct types of Denisovans, where we wouldn't even call them Denisovans really, because some of them are so distinct, like 200, 300,000 years separate. So groups, they'd lived separately for 200 to 300,000 years, right? So really, at that point, they are now subspecies or different species. So you've got those lineages, and they're unique to Papua. So what this suggests? It suggests there is a flow of people, Denisovans, Neanderthals, modern humans, who are all crossing the Indonesia Islands and ending up in northern Sahul, in Papua. And at that time, you know, remember, Papua isn't an island, because we haven't had the Younger Dryas sea rises, okay? So this is all one landmass. And yet they find this very clear genetic divergence between the northern people of Australasia and the southern people. And they said the only way you can explain this, again, it goes back at least 40, 50,000 years, this divergence, that the only logical way to explain why you'd have that on a singular landmass is the people in the south don't count the people in the north as the same as them. And there is an interbreeding taboo. Because they're looking at those people, James, they don't look like us, right? They can see that these are not normal modern humans, that you now have this kind of hybridized race of people that are mixed with Denisovans and Neanderthals, and everyone who escaped from the cataclysm to the north is now basically hiding on these islands and on northern Sahul. And we can see it in the DNA and those languages. Let's be honest, some of those languages are Denisovan languages, which is amazing to think. But there are still people today, I would argue, speaking Denisovan languages in Papua. And that's why we've got all these crazy languages that are totally isolated from all the other languages of the world, right? But that hasn't been taken seriously. And yet, you know, these things are like hand-waved away. You know, Papua has 60% of the world's languages. Oh, well, what does that mean, Jay? You know, what is, you know, well, it's going to mean something really, like, important if you think about it, because there's no other reason why you'd see that on one island, right? And the fact that they have all of this divergent DNA, you'd think our leading academics would put one and one together and come up with two, especially as Denisovan DNA is not seen strongly in any other populations in the world, right? It's uniquely strong when you go east of Wallace's line and into Oceania. And like I made the argument in my book that this is almost certainly the homelands of the Denisovans, because you basically don't really see much trace of them anywhere else. Either you find the cave site in Siberia, you found some bones up in the Himalayas. The only place with a strong genetic signature is Oceania. So, right, so that is basically what they seem to end up as their homelands, right? But all of this is non-conventional wisdom that comes out looking at the hard science. This is what we got, what I was talking about earlier. You know, I don't sit there and go, I'm going to come up with this great story. You know, it's going to be about Denisovans living in Papua. You know, they're going to speak English. Like, I look at the actual data that's in the papers that's coming out. I read it and I look at the interpretations the anthropologists are offering, and I can see it's absurd. You know, there was another argument where they said the people got to Flores, and you'll be familiar with the Hobbit people of Flores. I'm sure most people have heard the story about these diminutive people that were, you know, their remains have been found and their tools have been found. We know that there was these little people on Flores. Right. We also know that the first people arrived there a million years ago. Now, because the mainstream didn't want to give them boats, they were arguing that maybe a population of people got washed across on a tsunami. And you just sit there thinking, head scratching, that someone would sit there and seriously think that's a mechanism to move a viable population from Southeast Asia to Flores. Is that these, you know, all these people?
I think you've blunted down your Occam's razor at that point. That's not really a very rational explanation.
No, the idea that you have a whole viable population, so let's say 100 or 200 people, that all somehow washed from the coast of Southeast Asia. You got
hold on tight.
Some of the strongest currents in the world. And they're all on this giant wave. You know, in fact, tsunami waves at sea aren't even that big anyway. So you're not really on anything until you get to land. So they're these really strange ideas. You're just washed out to sea and somehow what, you swam across to Flores? I mean, I don't think so, bro. I don't think you're going to make that. And the idea that so many people could make it in one go, that you'd have a population. So, you know, you suddenly sit and you think, that's why I said about storytelling, that if I was to tell you the story where they had a raft that they made from bamboo, which is common to the region in Southeast Asia, and that they realized looking at bamboo that it floats, right? And that you could just get some reeds and tie some back. I mean, or I say there's this wave and all these people swimming across the most dangerous currents in the world, and somehow they defy all the odds. And they, you know, I think any rational person would sit and I think, Bruce has got a better point here. In terms of they probably just had a boat, you know, rather than this absurd idea, just because you're defending the idea these people didn't have votes, because it's a problem for other hypotheses you're making elsewhere, right? That you don't want these people to have votes, because then you have to go back and question other papers that you're relying on or that you've written where the people didn't have votes, you know, where there were no votes until recently. And that, again, that's been an issue. Again, with the populating Australia, that, you know, they said, oh, 50,000 years ago, people came up with boats, you know, during the Arab African migration, and they managed to somehow sail across to Australia, and that's when it first happened. But then they're finding sites in Australia that are 80,000 years old, 120,000 years old. You know, there's a couple of different shell midden sites that suggest 120. There are areas that look like they had human, you know, engineered burning of landscapes going back 120,000 years. And I was in a chat thread with some of the anthropologists that were writing on these discoveries, including some of the most eminent thinkers on the topic. And one of them said, you know, is it time we revisit the out of Australia theory, something that there may be modern humans emerge in Australia and that we've got this completely wrong. And that's where it goes back to some of my other work, because of course, literally I'm the person who wrote the book on that idea, that there's an out of Australia theory which is superior to the out of Africa theory. And another two things, I'll give you the overview. It's basically, there's some evidence that's come up again recently to support this, but if people take into account from an effort I just said, which again questions the mainstream view, puts Denisovans down there, puts modern humans there earlier, you know, completely changes this view, shows we had boats, we're moving around these islands. Like, all of that is basically only now you'll find some of the mainstream scientists have started to shift gradually towards some of these views. But we also know that, you know, if you think about it, if Homo erectus and maybe some other Australopithecine or whatever, some ancestor of these hobbit people, if these essentially archaic hominins can get across to Florence a million years ago, they've done the hard work. And this is agreed again by the activists. You've done the hard work. You've crossed Wallace's line, which is the geological barrier between Southeast Asia and Oceania. So all those powerful currents going through the islands, you've managed to do the hard work. You've crossed into Flores. At that point, there is nothing stopping you reaching the enormous continent to the south. Absolutely nothing. Right. So why would it take 950,000 years after crossing Wallace's line for humans to reach Australia? The big question, I'll pitch that big glowing question mark over the academic's head. How are you selling me this story where you now agree, yes, they've somehow sailed across or washed across, however you want to look at it, but they've reached Flores and these other islands 950,000 years before you're saying they got to Australia? Doesn't it seem more likely that soon after some of them reach Australia, like very soon after? And I'm quite generous in my book. I say, let's give them 100,000 years. I think that's overly generous. But you could be washed across by accident in that time, let alone plan to go there. You could see Australia from the mountains of Flores, right? So this idea that, you know, nobody would try it, it just is absurd. The other thing is, we've now found some really amazing evidence. Again, someone can look this up later, but it appears that around about 900,000 years ago, there is a profound bottleneck in human DNA. I've seen this news story quite recently. They said that it looked like something like 95% or something of the population just vanishes. And so they're saying, well, what kind of event, what kind of cataclysm, you know, could do that? You know, where are all these, why could it go from so many, you know, breeding pairs down to so few so quickly? And now there's no signs of a disease. And in fact, there's no signs of a cataclysm, you know, because we still find the fossils from other hominins around the world. So what's going on? And so there's a kind of bafflement. Well, there's two ways you can end up with a bottleneck. One way is, yes, there's a cataclysm and most people die, and so you end up with a really drastically smaller population. Or you migrate. You migrate to somewhere where there's not many people and you're cut off from everyone else. Well, the only places that can happen is Australia, right? It's a cut-off continent, yeah? All the other continents, you can walk between them, right? So if you think about it, we now know there are humans a million years ago down in those islands. Not a big leap to say that they have now reached Australia within 900,000 years ago. We see this bottleneck in the DNA of our ancestors at that time, yeah? And then the other funny thing is that the bottleneck, I think it lasts until about 700,000 years ago, and suddenly there is an increase in the breeding pair number again. Well, where did these people magically appear from then? Because they can't just come out of the ground. In other words, it looks like the people sail back, right? So they've had a period of isolation down in Australia, and then the population expands. And when they expand back out into the world, they encounter the other living hominins. So the remnants, say, you know, you've still got Homo erectus populations and stuff out there, right? And anyone who's evolved from them. So they encounter them and they are breeding with them again, right? So then there's an expansion of the breeding pool again. But the funny thing is, well, that they've also said that they think in this time is when we get the chromosome 2 event. So they're now starting to date this to the same period, that we get this end-to-end fusion in chromosome 2, and that occurs during this bottleneck. So it happens to these people who have been cut off in this environment. They are now changed in a fundamental way at that genomic level. They come back out as a new kind of people. In other words, the first Homo sapiens. And then these first Homo sapiens come out of Australia, migrate into, you know, to Southeast Asia and spread out to Eurasia, to Africa, and that we have to completely rethink that story that has been told to us endlessly about Africa. That this is where our ancestors, there's no other human, but this is where our ancestors, Homo sapiens, are emerging in this bottleneck event. And then they essentially take over the world. The other things we see is the total eradication or replacement of the other population, because today we only have people with 46 chromosomes, you know, unless you have a chromosomal error. You know, so the 48 chromosome population is totally replaced in this breeding event. So it looks like that we are, you say, better at surviving, better at, you know, tackling environments, and we end up becoming the dominant species globally. Yeah, either that or when you reproduce, the children have 46 chromosomes, no matter who is breeding with them. There's something's going on here that leads to a total replacement. Now, this, again, I mean, I'll just say this, of course, does dovetail with some of my other work, the idea that something really profound happens in Australia, and it's not just natural evolution.
Well, this is what I want to get into as we just kind of wrap up for the last, like, 30 minutes or so, is the tektites. And obviously, like, you know, I agree with you completely. What you're saying is fascinating. It just speaks to an absolute need for a revision in our historical narratives. And, you know, to be honest, like you said, stories, they're just stories more than anything else. And there are more compelling stories surfacing now that need to be looked at more critically, like what you're highlighting. But let's get into, for the last half an hour or so, the Australite tektite mystery. Now, we did a podcast on this a while back. I'd recommend people check that out, because we dedicated pretty much the entire time to it. But for those who aren't familiar, this is pretty interesting. So I'd love for you to just take some time to break it down.
Sure. And I'll give a very brief background to how this came about. Because it is a, you know, it was a strange kind of detour, you know. So I think most people have a sense now of, you know, my background and things I've been involved with, mostly ancient mysteries, human stories, how we moved around. You know, these were topics that I was fascinated with. But what happened to me was after becoming involved with this lost site in Ecuador, that led on to, because I ended up in the press, it was kind of picked up by Science Channel, and then they invited me across to Georgia. I went on this Science Channel thing where we had to go find some giant bones up in the Caucasus. And then from there, I kind of ended up, during that period, I should say, I ended up connecting with some Australian researchers, Stephen Evan Strong, who were aware of this claim that there'd been a visitation event in Australia, that there was this, you know, there's a book basically called Altering When the First Ancestors Were Created. And in it, there is this story about a visitation event, modifying of humans, stuff that was allegedly given to a group of people who encountered an ancient Aboriginal artifact and went through a kind of, I suppose we'd call it a mystical telepathic kind of experience, where it seemed that this artifact was intelligent and that they were given this story. Now, it's a wild claim, of course, wild sounding claim, you know, talking Aboriginal artifact, telling them about a lost visitation by aliens. But the thing is, some of what they were saying in the story matched some personal experiences we'd had, because I actually had had, myself and my wife had had what I would call contact with some kind of intelligence. And that began 2011, after I went to Egypt. I visited Cairo and was at a special site there. I'm trying to think what it's called now. Not far from the pyramids, anyway. There's a kind of sun temple ruin. And, you know, whilst I was there, I had this really strange experience where I was trying to draw towards the Pleiades and had this kind of, I guess you'd call it like kind of a internal conversation with something that I couldn't see, you know. So again, I kind of psychical experience that there was some kind of intelligence in the direction of the Pleiades that was aware and interacting at that site. So, and strange as that sounds, that was my experience. And I was almost having a conversation of, you know, why have you, you know, disconnected from this world? You know, why aren't you here helping? You know, this world's a mess. And that was the kind of, it just came up from nowhere. I can't explain it. Now, nothing immediately happened. But about 2 months after that, my now wife, Danielle, then not my wife, but she was my friend, she started having intelligent contact with entities or intelligences that suggested that they were linked with the Pleiades. So we'd had these really intense experiences were going on. So this is why when I heard about this story of a Pleiades connection and this visitation, you know, I didn't just dismiss it. I thought, well, hang on a minute. You know, this kind of seems to link with things that we've had going on in our personal lives. So I'm going to look at it and see whether there's maybe something here, something to it, and something I could validate. And I sort of said to myself, I won't go talking about this story unless I can validate some of the core claims in this book Alter Ego, When the First Ancestors Were Created. So actually it's published 2003. Right. So it's got a timestamp on it as well. So nobody can add in, you know, new details. You know, that's what they claimed was said. And so I took the information from the book and I went looking for the core claims. And now the core claims are that there was an enormous ship, essentially a crystalline ship, a living AI ship that arrived here and was destroyed in orbit. And they described material melting, raining down across the landscape. I thought, well, you know, that could leave traces, you know, enormous like mega structure, raining down silica, melt glass. So that was one of the main ones. They also said that some of the survivors came down, modified people in Australia. So again, this is happening above Australia, that the survivors come down at a place called Gosford, and that they then realize they can't survive here, that they need their genetic engineering technologies to modify themselves, that this is something that was in process before their craft is destroyed. And again, I thought, well, that's very logical, because you hear these stories about aliens just, you know, walking around, you know, on Earth, or, and you think, well, how could they, right? Different air, different gravity, you know, different bacterial environment. But here we're getting a logical explanation. It's like, well, no, we don't just land and live there. Now, en route, we've already started re-engineering ourselves so that we can live there. And the destruction of the main science lab on the ship means that we can't do that, that it's game over, and that we're all unsuited. And they said it's sort of dying. You know, the radiation is killing them. The air isn't right, that they're not ready to live there. So they come up with this secondary idea that instead of colonizing Earth, they will colonize via the existing hominins by changing them to be more like themselves and giving them their thinking, culture, and their identity, essentially, right? So this is a kind of proxy colonization instead of a proxy war that we have these days. So we have a proxy colonization event. So I thought, well, that's kind of fascinating, because that's a narrative you don't hear much in these kind of aliens claims. Again, made some sense as to why they're doing this. And then the third part of this was a claim that 5 years after this event, that they have a follow-up mission from other beings that allied with them, who turn up and are basically like a cosmic police almost. They're like, you know, this ship's been destroyed. You know, the beings have done it. You know, they're in these other underground bases on Earth. They're a negative kind of presence. They've ambushed one of our alliance ships, and we're going to pulverize them. They sort of warn them, get off the planet, or else, as the ones who don't leave, we unleash a bombardment from space. But this is not an ordinary bombardment. They pull in asteroids and bombard the planet with asteroids. Again, that's a wild claim if it wasn't real, right? Because that should leave traces. So the thing I took from the book was these three major things. I thought, well, a destroyed megastructure made of silica, that could leave traces. Engineering the genome of humans should leave traces. And a multi-directional bombardment, right? That's got to leave traces, yeah? And so I thought, I said, well, look, I mean, I'm not going to come out straight away and talk about this until I checked these enough. So over a period of time, I did a deep dive. And I was frankly astonished to find that, yeah, there is this mysterious rain of glass, of silica glass, that occurs 788,000 years ago. It's called the Australasian Tektite Strewn Field. And for over 130 years, scientists have been trying to understand the exact cause of this glassy rain. And so there's been a lot of different hypotheses. The two main ones were an impact of a very large object somewhere in Indochina. And you've got to explain the material going up into space, raining down across 10,000 kilometers, right? So you need a really exotic event, an impact that launches things into space, and somehow they come back at the right angles. So that was one argument. Another argument was that an impact on the moon launched lunar glass across and it rained down, right? But so you had these really exotic arguments to try to explain it. Now, then on the other side, you had this multi-directional bombardment. And that was a big problem. So I was like, well, I've never heard of that. And I thought, well, if that's real, surely we'd have all heard of it. Because it's like, you know, we all hear about the dinosaur impact event, you know, we're aware of these kinds of mega destruction events. They're usually about geospatials and stuff, right? So I was kind of surprised. I thought, well, maybe it's not real. Maybe, you know, again, I found one thing that seems to fit, but, you know, maybe that's just a bit of luck. You never know. And then I found actually in 2016, keep in mind the book was published in 2003, so it cannot be added to the claims, right? So anything that it could be known at the time, you can argue she took it from the, you know, something like that, right? You can say, well, maybe you just cherry picked it. The fact is, in 2016, a team of geologists identified a multi-directional impact event, and they found what seems to be an asteroid hitting in Central America, Canada, like Laos, Tasmania, and I think there might be one other. But they said got multiple impacts, and when they tested the materials at the sites, they concluded not only that it seemed like the dates were so close that they were probably part of one event, but the materials were sort of significantly different, so they couldn't be part of one object. So you sometimes say, well, you know, this is a comet, you know, like a meteorite breaking up or a comet breaking up, it causes a swarm. No, these are distinct objects coming in from different sides of the planet at the same time. And that is really weird, because you don't have that happening. Usually one large object hits every, I think it's every 100,000 years. You get one large bombardment, right? But you don't get several of them coming in at the same time from different sides. That straight away stood out to me. Even they don't really say in the paper, but it's obviously weird, right? It's just obviously weird that that would be happening. Why would that happen? And then, so I thought, well, you've got now two really strange, mysterious events. This glassy rain that nobody seems to be able to properly explain, 10,000-kilometer long field of melted glass raining from the sky. Yeah, and now you've got the most striking impact. And again, the dates on these events are the same, so the impacts and the glass. Right, so you know this is all happening around the same period. And then, of course, the third one was this claim that there'd been some genetic engineering. I think, well, we'll ask them the most interesting one, because it's about us. You know, if that's true, it's so profound. It's so altering of our story that even more so than aliens come in, quite frankly, because it's one thing to say aliens came here, you know, they visited and they left and wow, it's really cool, but they've gone. And that's, you know what I mean? That's really cool, but it's not as profound as saying, and they engineered us, right? So I'm thinking if that bit's true, that's going to be immense. So because of my work on the other book, you know, on human origins and stuff, I had an understanding already of kind of our story. And I know that, you know, I knew already that in the last kind of few years, there's been a radical revision and a redating of the emergence of our species. So it went from being that it was thought that about 400,000 years ago we emerged, and like 200,000 years ago or so we diverged from Neanderthals. All of that story has gone out the window. Instead, now it's basically recognized that around about 800,000 years ago, there was a divergence from all the what we call super archaics, so like Homo erectus and anyone else that was around. There was a divergence at the genetic level that leads to Homo sapiens, Neanderthals, Denisovans, all of the large-brained humans. Now that breaking away event happens around 800,000 years ago. So that's recognized at the genomic level. We know that something profound happens that launches this new line that will give us all of these large-brained humans. Right on that dating. So the date they give is like 750 to 800,000 years ago. So right on our date again of 788,000 years ago, it nicely sort of wedged into that period, right? That we have the beginnings of all these lineages. And also, if you dig a bit deeper, you find that there are profound anomalies that are leading to these new people. I'll give them a fairly brief example, not only too technical, but I think people do need to know them. Because it's easy to say, you know, oh, ancient aliens guy believes aliens made people. You know, it's an old trope in the community. There's plenty of people that are selling the idea that, you know, ancient aliens came here and modified humans. But what they don't tend to do is make a genetic argument for this, right? They just say that we're weird, we've got big brains, and, you know, we've got chromosome 2 fusion, ergo, we must be engineered, which is a very simplistic argument. It's why it gets rejected by scientists, right? And most skeptics. But it's much more profound than that. It turns out that If you look into the human genome, particularly in the non-coding regions, and so this is what used to be called junk DNA. You look in these regions, it's not junk. Basically, these are like mostly regulatory segments. So they regulate how the genes are expressed, like whether a gene even expresses, how much it expresses, you know, they're like on-off switches and, you know, they change how everything else works. It's super important. You've got areas in there as well that are called like highly conserved or super conserved regions. And the reason they're called that is because if you look across all mammals, you will find there are segments in that non-coding DNA that are essentially identical, no matter what animal you look at, right? Because it's doing something so profoundly important that it hasn't changed in like 100 million years, right? Because it maybe gives you lungs or something. You know what I mean? There's something that it's doing that you can't turn that off without killing the organism. So natural selection and mutation, it is not really affecting it. Well, when they started to analyze, you know, and look between humans and other animals, what they found is actually that we have hundreds of segments where these areas have been rapidly accelerated. I think we touched on it. I gave the same as I think I gave you before, is the HAR1, the first one that was found, which is it was seen in, you know, compared between a chicken, a chimpanzee, and a human being. Now it's about 118 DNA letters long, which is very short for a gene, but it's, you know, it's a short segment of code. And they looked to see, you know, what were the differences. And so they found that between a chicken and a chimpanzee, two letters had changed in 300 million years. So, okay, gives you your mutation rate, right? 150, well, one selection per 150 million years is successful, right? The rest of the time, it can't change it. So you look then between the chimp and the human being, who supposedly have had 7 to 8 million years, maybe a little bit more, there should be no change. And so they expected to be identical. Instead, 18 letters had changed. So the mutation rate had sped up so much that it was just, you know, it was just totally out of the ballpark of what should be there. And they ran their own kind of, you know, analysis over this using, you know, specialized software. And they came to the conclusion that basically there was a close to 0% chance that this could occur by any understood natural evolutionary mechanisms. That's their words, right? You know, not my thinking, although it seems obvious to me too, but that was what they kind of concluded. Now, since then, they have found hundreds of these. And not only are they, you know, they start to look at closer, but they found that over 50% of them are to do with the brain, particularly the fetal development of the human brain. Does that sound random? Does it sound so random if it's over 50% our amazing brain? And so that's the ones that we know. Now, that on its own, I think a lot of people say, well, you know, sounds like something's been done there, Bruce. You know, you got me there. But it doesn't stop there. That we also now, they found very recent, again, this is all recent work. They've now noted that there is profound deletions of code as well in these areas. So they said it seems like something that said are missing large segments of code. They said this should be really deleterious. It should be causing all kinds of problems. He said, but it seems that where these deletions have happened, pieces of code are now interacting that help give us our brain. What? Hang on. You know, I'm saying this should be killing us, not giving us our brain, right? So you've now got, again, unexpected acceleration, unexpected deletions, you know, a chromosomal fusion that is beneficial, not a problem, it's beneficial. So you start to get to think, well, yeah, this is sounding a bit wacky. And then the other one they found was, and again, I think this is about a year ago, is a three-dimensional refolding of the genome. They said, so this is where the parts of the genome are now connecting to new areas. And again, guess what was helping you, Jay? I think you can guess, our brain, you know. So again, it said you seem to be involved in the changes that lead to our brain. And the other thing they said is that this occurs as a singular event. It's not the product of gradual mutations. They said this has to have happened in a single generation, probably in one egg or sperm or one fetus, as it is an instant event with a total refolding, reconfiguration of the genome. Now, if you start putting these things together, you think, so of all the mammals, like that we know, all the, again, this is, I'm not trying to, you know, cherry pick here, you know, the Zoonomia Project, which has looked across all these mammal genomes, is telling us that this is just in humans, right? Just in humans. You look and you find that there's this three-dimensional folding, that there is, you know, these massive number of deletions, these massive number of addition, you know, accelerations, this chromosomal end-to-end fusion event. It's all happening in us. And what does it do? It leads to those lineages of large brain humans. And it occurs right on the time we're looking at for this event that we're told in this information is a visitation. Now, I don't know about you, but when you start to get, say, two or three profoundly influencing events that are aligned in time, right, that it looks connected, even without someone saying to you, oh, there was aliens. If I said to you, Jay, think about it, you know, this is time, 788,000 years ago. I'm going to tell you a few things that happened. You tell me if you think they're connected. You know, you've got a strange multi-directional bombardment of the planet by asteroids. You've got the emergence, the sudden genetic changes that would lead to all large-brained humans. You've got a weird crystalline rain that rains from the skies, you know, across a 10,000-kilometer-long path. And you also have the last full geomagnetic reversal, bang on that time. That's the last time the reversal occurred. And you also have at that time the destabilizing of the ice age cycles, right, that leads to longer warm periods for human beings to form civilizations, right? Isn't that convenient too? And these are all happening at the same time. Wouldn't you feel like something odd is going on at that time?
Nah, you're just connecting dots that don't exist. Don't be silly. pseudo archaeology and science. No, absolutely. I mean, like, you know, these are big, significant patterns that talk towards something that actually, you know, it's starting to feel evidential. It's fascinating to me because I haven't actually seen anyone else other than yourself digging into this tektite mystery. I didn't even hear about it until I heard about it from you on our first podcast.
Yeah, the tektite mystery, I'll be honest, I was kind of blindsided of that too. I'd never heard of it. I didn't know that. I thought I knew of most mysteries. Right. I didn't know about the tektite mystery until I'd heard of this story and went to look if there was ever, a strange rain of glass from an object, you know. And it turned out that not only was there, but that it was a head scratcher. But, you know, you had top scientists across loads of different disciplines, and NASA engineers, you know, loads of the guys involved with NASA rocket scientists, you know, so, you know, top tier scientists who were saying that, well, particularly the NASA guys actually were the ones saying that we think this has to have come in from space. And they didn't agree with the impact theory. They were saying that, well, look, because when you see the shaping, and again, some people look for the tektite buttons. If you see the shaping of an Australite tektite button, it's like a nose cone of a rocket ship. Rocket scientists know about things like that, right? So they're looking at it saying, well, this is aerodynamic reshaping during entry. So we can recreate that in the NASA Ames Flight Lab. You know, they did. They recreated the shapes. And they realized that the only way to explain it was if a parent body broke up in orbit, and that these are pieces that carried on orbital paths, and then they glance along the atmosphere and have secondary melting, where they're reshaped into these aerodynamic shapes, and then eventually fall down. They said, well, that's a problem, because that is not what you expect from an impact. Even if the impact is powerful enough to throw the material into space, it shouldn't then be in orbital paths, glancing along, you know, these gentle paths along the atmosphere, because these are, you said, they're characteristic of a larger object breaking up in orbit, because we see it with satellites, they understand this, right? So they could trace back and see the reshaping has to occur in that way. Well, that leaves you a big problem, because what kind of object would be in orbit, first of all, and it has to be big, because there are billions of tons of this glass spread across, you know, 10,000 kilometers. So you've got to think an object that's probably kilometers across, right? How has it ended up in orbit? Right, that's one big question, because we usually capture very small asteroids temporarily. There's no known case of very large objects, you know, being caught, either escaping again or breaking up. We don't know. We don't believe that it can happen. We don't. It's not Jupiter and other, but yeah, larger bodies do this. We don't think that Earth could do that. So you've got a very unlikely event. This massive object is somehow in orbit. But the second thing is, if it's not an impact, then this object is made of silica. It's made of quartz, because the material is melted quartz. So you've now got the weirdest asteroid you can think of, because it's got to be like 75% quartz crystal. What? What is this thing? You know, at that point, you're going to be asking yourself, this doesn't seem right. This doesn't seem like a normal asteroid. And then it's, you know, somehow it superheats and it's melted to liquid. But why would a natural object in the cold of space superheat to liquid, right? And then the liquid drops, they re-harden into these little balls, and those carry on in orbital paths and are reshaped. I mean, there's no mechanism really for an object to superheat to liquid in space.
It's a frustrating one, isn't it? Because it's like, you know, the idea of aliens or anything like that is already put into this weird basket, even though it actually feels like logical leaps. If you remove the bias, if you remove all of your training and just look at it, it's like, okay, well, actually, that makes more sense than all of these crazy, you know, cosmological phenomena we're trying to invoke, but it's still considered more rational than the alien hypothesis, you know?
Absolutely. And this is the problem I've come up against is that, I mean, in all the papers that I've read on this, only once was, I think it was one NASA scientist or something, said kind of like, well, what if there was an object from out of the solar system that somehow, you know, ended up in orbit? But then he kind of, you know, he does that kind of thing. But then what kind of object could end up in orbit and explode? You know, so he was like, he almost, you know, you
just look at a little step there and then.
You're so close. You just need to go one step further. But the box was too tight. You know? I mean, he couldn't quite go there. He could think that maybe we need to think of something else here, something from outside our solar system that's different and, you know, behaves in a different way. But then what kind of natural object would that be? You know what I mean? That's the problem. If you're limiting it to natural objects, then you probably cannot invoke it, right? Because it's not behaving naturally. It's parking in orbit and then it's superheating at some point. And that's not natural.
Oh.
So they couldn't say, well, what about an alien craft? You know, they just couldn't go there. And like nobody else has gone there. And it doesn't matter that this is following the logical progression and that nobody's explained this mystery. You know, it's not like it's, well, Bruce, it's totally explained. Like, why are you trying to invoke a mystery that's not there? You know, this is recognized and it's not properly explained. And I know that I'll probably have some people, you know, trying to push back. But I can tell you now that there are elements to this that make the impact super problematic. I don't want to go too deep. I'll give you one of them because it's probably one of the main ones. So like, people say, well, okay, if it was an impact, there's a couple of things we should see. First of all, this impact would have to be on the scale of the dinosaur killing impact, right? To put stuff back into space. Now, you'd see a global cataclysm, right? Because we know that, because we have one that killed the dinosaur, right? You know, I mean, we see this, the fingerprints of species lost, changed climate, everything when that impact occurs, right? For this event, and bear in mind, it's only 780,000 years ago, we see no traces of a global cataclysm. There is no iridium layer. There's no K2 boundary-like iridium layer that you should see all around the world in dust samples, right, in the rock. There's nothing like that. It's not in the seabed cores. Right? You find tektites there, but you don't find any layer of ash or anything like that. So there's no sign of a cataclysm. There's no sign of a species eradication in Australia or, you know, in these areas where supposedly you'll be impacted. You know, so across Southeast Asia and Australia where this stuff is, there's no sort of loss of species. You know, none of those things, Jay, that you would expect from a cataclysmic impact. The other thing is the material as well. I've seen someone invoke this idea of being superheated to a certain temperature where it would allow it to liquidize, go to space. Basically, it's quite a complex argument. But basically, they recognize there's little fragments of crystal in the material. They say that this would be destroyed at the heats that are necessary to argue the conventional theory. So they're there. He says, in other words, it cannot be the temperatures that you invoke to explain it. So, you know, there's these little technical points where if someone was to say to me, oh, but Bruce, you know, there's mainstream people telling you you're wrong, I can tell you now, I can counter those arguments using the studies that are out there. I don't make up anything. I can just point them to a different study, which will say, no, that doesn't work. And that's why it remains a mystery. So I don't know. Yeah, the thing is, and I know I've got time, but I'll say this, is that to me, this project has made aliens far more real, and I'd say uncomfortably real, where it goes from where I was used to the idea that, you know, yeah, maybe aliens are there, maybe they're psychically contacting people, maybe there's things flying around in our sky, but it's always a little bit on the edge of maybe, you know, you can sort of allow it to be a story, you know, that maybe it's true, maybe it's not. Maybe we're having just psychical contact, which I think most UFO and alien contact, I think, would fall into a shamanic-y, psychical, you know, even plasmas flying around. All sorts of other stuff that we can explain a lot of the UFO and alien contact phenomena with. But this case actually really made me somewhat uncomfortable because it's like, well, hang on, this is like actually physical aliens in a real physical craft, physically interacting with our world and changing us and our environment. And that brings it to reality in a way that I've found no other case does. Because, you know, there's always an out. But on this one, you've got the material holding your hands, you know, and you know there's a mystery to it. You can look in the genome and you can see that there's something weirdly wrong. And it all begins with an artifact that is held by the Aboriginal people. Okay, it's called a Tjuringa. That when you are near it, it seems to be able to relay information. And there is an object known to modern science, like, well, a theoretical object. It's called a Bracewell Sentinel probe. Right? It's a hypothetical alien technology that if you were an advanced species, you would leave advanced AI probes monitoring interesting planets, either in the atmosphere, either orbiting or on the surface, so that you can monitor the progression of an evolving species and make contact when the time is right. I think this thing makes so much sense. Like, because then they can relay and act as an ambassador to an alien civilization on multiple, all around the galaxy. You could have these things sitting on planets. And so this artifact that the Aboriginal people have, particularly the Arente people, and we've got lore about this, it seems to be those definitions. And they say it was left here in the dream time by these creator beings, and that either it was made by them or that they became it, and that it was a sentient object that is connected to the human soul in some way, and that is, is hidden away, is taboo, is supposed to be only elders that can touch it, and that it has some kind of, it's also a message rock, and it's, so all this lore about it, when you think about it, the lore is identical to the modern story of a Bracewell probe, that, they're an object that would have those characteristics, sentient, with the messages in it, intelligent, you have to be careful with it, it knows all sorts of stuff, so it's only the elders can interact with it. And it now wants to make contact. And one of the things that was always hypothesized, if we encountered a Bracewell probe, is it might have a complete record of the human story. Because if it's been monitoring us the whole time, it would know everything, right? It would know what happened. Because that's its purpose, is monitoring a planet. So the very story it tells us, or the lost story of our origin, is the kind of thing that we think a Bracewell probe would know. So it's again, this stuff, although it sounds on the face, it's super weird. The thing that actually gets me more is it's exactly the expectations of what we would expect in an encounter with that kind of technology. And yet, the scientists are supposed to be looking for this stuff. If you sat down and said it to them, that stuff you theorize and how it could happen, they don't really believe it. They're telling you, yeah, we're looking for aliens and we think they'll have probes. But if you were to sit with them, you could imagine the half smile where they thought, get this crank out of my office, even though that's what they claim they're looking for.